Hello and welcome to the latest in our Convex podcast series with me, journalist and broadcaster Helen Fospero. Today I'm chatting to Ben Warner, founder of the incredibly popular and much-loved cafe and restaurant chain Benugo, and finding out the ups and downs he's encountered on his path to success. Ben and his brother Hugo opened their first cafe in Clerkenwell in 1998, and more than 20 years on, their business has a turnover of more than £100 million, involving almost 3,000 staff. As well as being on the high street, they have cool establishments in places like the V&A, the Natural History and Science Museums, Royal Parks, City Institutions, and the British Film Institute. Ben, thanks very much for finding time to join me today. Your love of food started really young, didn't it, when you were growing up?
Yeah, well, it did. Thanks, Helen, for that wonderful introduction. I have to say, couldn't have said it better myself. But yeah, I mean, I'm a member of a very large family. I have 8 brothers and sisters, so there's 9 children in our family. And food was a massive part of our family upbringing. And my mother was a great cook. So every dinner time was sort of feeding time at the zoo in our house. And she cooked and the food was put in front of you. And there was no option to whether you liked it or not liked it. You either ate it or didn't eat it. There was never an alternative to the food my mother cooked. So we were all encouraged very much to bake and make pancakes and cook and make cakes. So, we grew up as reasonably good chefs. And actually, you know, being a rather poor performer at school, and in fact, I left school when I was 15. Those days, there weren't really many alternatives for me to do, having no academic qualifications, and food was a great love to me. So it made total sense to go and try and be a chef, which I did. And I was very lucky to get some training under Raymond Blanc at the time in Oxford, in the Maison Blanc, when I was 16, and worked for him for a couple of years, learning the finer art of French patisserie and baking. So that's what set me off on the course that I took.
Interestingly, we got married at Le Manoir, actually, at Raymond Blanc's beautiful Oxfordshire hotel. And I've interviewed Raymond a few times. He's a fabulous French character. What was it like being under his tutorage, if you like?
He's a charmer, but he's a tough man. But you know what? I learned so much. And one of the biggest things I learned was the discipline of what's actually required to run a business to the standard that he is able to do, and the dedication that you need from your team to be able to do it, and the absolute amazing provenance of the food that someone like that brought in. I mean, when I worked for him, the actual flour was imported from France. You know, the British flour wasn't good enough. It all had to come in from France. The butter came in from France. If he could have bought the water in from France, he would have done. So they were totally authentic. You know, the baguettes that we produced were totally authentic. And I just learned the difference. I worked many, many hours, and it was obviously a time where all my mates were out partying and having a good time, and I was working 6 nights a week in a bakery in Oxford. So I really felt that I was getting the real understanding of how to work hard and run a business, and being a bit flaky at school, it was probably quite good for me.
When you say you were a bit flaky at school, did you not really enjoy school?
No, I did actually. I did. I went to the local comprehensive school in Wallingford, and it was actually a really nice school, and I did a lot of rowing at school. So rowing was a big thing for me. It was one of the very few comprehensive schools that did actually row. And we were very, very good. You know, we won virtually everything. I won the National Rowing Championships when I was 15 and 14. And so that was also quite good discipline. Academia was never a thing for me, although weirdly enough, I sort of quite enjoy it now. I mean, history was never a subject I liked at school, but I quite like reading history books now. So it's all come around, really. But no, qualifications were something that eluded me, I have to be honest with you. But I had no issues with the school at all. It was great.
And you're dyslexic, aren't you, Ben? I just wondered whether that made studying a bit, you know, the academia a bit more tricky for you.
Yeah, in those days, I think, I'm talking those days, it wasn't that long ago, 40-odd years ago, dyslexia wasn't really recognised as it is today. I mean, you were really just seen as being a bit thick when you were dyslexic. So that was quite a problem, really, because you ended up being put into very poor classes. And actually, you could intellectualise most things, you just couldn't say it or spell it or add it up. So it probably knocked my confidence as far as academic work was concerned. And And actually, funny enough, a lot of dyslexic people do go on to do other creative things. It was good for me that I had the rowing. I think otherwise I would have been a complete and utter dropout at school.
Take us back, if you would, to 1998. You and your brother had raised, I think, around $150,000 from friends and family to open your first cafe. And then 2 weeks before the opening, the builder wanted more cash, didn't he? What happened?
So Benugo is two names, really, Ben and Hugo, hence the name. He'd never forgiven me, but we took the H out of his name. In fact, we opened under Ben Hugo. Then I thought it read better, Benugo, so we took the H out. And actually, weirdly enough, our idea wasn't sandwiches and salads. It was actually going to be wood-fired pizza. We found a site in Clerkenwell where I lived, and we were planning up to about 3 or 4 weeks before we actually opened to do the wood-fired pizza, and the oven was about to arrive, and then the issue was we didn't get the license. It was very difficult to get licenses in those days to actually burn wood, and we couldn't get the license. So about 2 or 3 weeks before, we had to turn it into a sort of New York style Italian deli, and Benugo was born. But we raised, I think, a couple of hundred thousand, which wasn't nearly enough, mainly from friends and family. So very close to the end, the builder came in and he said, well, we've still got to plaster the walls. And I said, well, look, listen, don't bother, you know, don't bother plastering the walls. We haven't got the cash to pay you. Funny enough, you know, we were about the first business to go for this stripped back sort of urban look. And it purely came out of the fact that we ran out of money. And what was so funny is that people came in afterwards, and actually many competitors sprang up around us, and they all went for the same look. And I always wonder if we plastered the walls, whether they would have gone with that look, but they didn't. And you see all these small little coffee people out there now all go for that strip back look. So I'm not sure whether I can completely take the credit for the strip back look, but it was certainly, I think, we were one of the first.
So in many ways, you're an accidental trendsetter with the brickwork. I know that you've carried on, you know, having that look in a lot of your places ever since. But what was the idea in the first place for opening the cafe together? What prompted you?
Well, look, I had worked in Pret for many years. So, you know, from leaving Raymond Blanc, I'd gone off and done various sort of chef's things around the world. I cooked on super yachts in the south of France, and which was all great fun. But eventually I came back to the UK having done some amazing things. And my father, who worked in the city, said to me, this was in the 80s, these really cool sandwich bars are springing up. You know, you should really get into sandwiches. So it was my dad who sort of said, and I thought, hang on a minute, I'm a chef, you know. I'm not going to make sandwiches, but I quickly learned that actually they could be quite lucrative. And I actually started by making sandwiches in my house. I rented a flat in Mile End, made sandwiches. I mean, this is way before health and safety kicked in, and even security within buildings kicked in. And I used to pile them up in baskets, drive out into the city and walk around these offices selling my sandwiches and flapjacks and orange juices and stuff. And it actually did really, really well. It was a good business. And actually, I put a little business case. I think British Gas were giving sponsorships and scholarships to people with business ideas. And I floated mine in front of them, and lucky enough that they accepted me, and they gave me a small unit up on the Holloway Road. And from there, I started producing food. And one of the customers I had was Pret, and used to supply them with things like crispy bacon and minted lamb and coronation chicken and stuff like that. And after a little while with that, Julian and Sinclair, who are the owners of Pret and a massive admirer of, they asked if I wanted to become a franchisee within Pret. And I did do that. And I opened two Pret franchises, and it was hugely successful. I mean, Pret were booming. The problem was, although they were my businesses, they were run like Pret's, and I always felt that I wanted my own thing, and I didn't want really someone else telling me what sandwiches I could sell or what cakes I could sell or how I could sell it. So from then I decided that actually my days with Pret would probably end, and they were very, very good to me, and they bought those stores back. So that allowed me a little bit of money at the time, and I wanted to open my own thing. And so I spent a little bit of time in New York looking at things and working a little bit out there. So big fan of places like Dean and DeLuca, and decided to open something similar, but more focused on takeaway food. So it wouldn't be the deli element. It would just be great sandwiches, great cakes, made for you in the way you wanted to. You know, I was a bit fed up with, you know, quite frankly, if you didn't like tomato or mayonnaise, there wasn't really much in Pret or eating Marks and Spencer's you could actually buy, because it was all made for you. Sort of sandwiches embalmed in plastic, sort of chilled to 4 degrees, wasn't my idea of a great sandwich. So we decided to go the other route, make it super, super healthy, great ingredients in a warehouse style emporium, stripped back by luck. Atmosphere will come from the colour and the abundance of food, as opposed to facts printed on bits of paper and shoved up on walls. You know, it will be warehouse with huge counters and sideboards groaning with amazing food. And that's how we first set off. And also great coffee. Unfortunately, we'd all started using these push button machines, which most of our competitors still use. And one thing that Benugo has remained true to is we would never use an automatic machine. We only ever use manual machines, which means you've got proper baristas rather than button pushers, which means, you know, you can actually give our guys and girls and everyone who works in Benugo some aspirations of learning to be great baristas or great bakers or great chefs. And that's how we went.
So whilst working behind the counter in Clerkenwell, because in those days you sort of did everything, didn't you? Mopping the floors and everything. You were approached by a customer who wanted 200 sandwiches for his office. And that was the start, really, wasn't it, Ben, of a pretty exciting and game-changing step into the city for you?
It was during the time of the, I think it was the 90s or late 90s, early 2000, there were the riots going on in London. All of the companies in the city were on lockdown, so they all closed their doors. And a guy I'd vaguely met through Pret and a few years earlier came running through the door and he said, look, I've asked Pret to make me, I think it was actually 500 sandwiches for my traders, and I need them in 3 hours, and they've just said they can't do it. Can you do it? I said, absolutely. So we raced around to Sainsbury's, bought extra bread and extra stuff, and we made these 500 sandwiches, and we delivered them about 3 hours later, and they were incredibly indebted. And this was Lehman Brothers. Sadly, Lehman Brothers isn't with us anymore. And he said, oh, by chance, we've got a little deli area on one of our trading floors, and we are tendering that out, and wondered whether you'd be interested in doing it or looking at it. So we said, yeah, yeah. He said, well, actually, it's tomorrow. Turn up tomorrow, and you've got to tell us what you can do. So it was quite interesting. We did turn up the next day with a sort of napkin with a couple of ideas on it, in a queue of people with huge tender documents and huge amounts of work they put in. But, you know, they were the big catering companies and they just weren't interested. And we were very lucky that the CEO of Lehman's just happened to be there on the same day that we were in, and walk into the room when Hugo and I were trying to decipher what was written on the back of our napkin. And she just liked us and she said, OK, I'm going to give you one chance. I'm going to turn up to your store in the next 3 days and see what I think. And she was American, brash American lady, full of enthusiasm and energy. And she did. And she actually turned up the next morning at 7:30 in the morning. And we just opened and she sat there for a few hours and drank the coffee and ate the muffins. And she just said, you got the gig. You got the gig. You're in.
And was that the start of you going into other financial institutions and really expanding?
The company that had been doing it before us had been taking about £400-£500 a day. So it was very, very poor. And we opened within a week, we were doing £3,000 a day. So it was a huge success. We're talking about a captive audience of wealthy people here. And we were giving them what they wanted, you know, amazing coffee, great Danish pastries, home-baked cakes, New York-style sandwiches, healthy salads, smoothies, juices, everything they wanted in the early 2000s, this was. And this is really before the high street in these things had got going. So we were inundated then by people wanting Benugo in their big corporate. So from then we went to Schroeder's, we opened in Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, in many, 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 many financial institutions right across the city. And in fact, we're still there. We're in PwC, we're in Deloitte's. Actually, it's still running really, really well. I mean, you know, it's a great business model. Before, they used to have to pay caterers to do it. We are a finance director's a perfect dream. We need very small spaces and we actually pay them to be there. So it's worked really, really well.
And you signed your first public space contract in 2004 with one of my favourite London haunts, the Victoria and Albert Museum. How exciting was that for you, Ben, when you walked into the V&A? I mean, it takes my breath away every time I visit, and realised that one of nine, grew up loving cooking at home, was about to open your first place in the V&A. I mean, that must have been amazing.
I have to say, I think the V&A is the greatest museum in the world. I really do. You know, the V&A is quite an interesting one as well, because in fact, by the time we opened in the V&A, I think we had about six or seven high street stores, and we had quite a few of our in-house stores. And You know, Benugo was not a particularly profitable. Any profits that we made, we sort of ploughed back into the business. Hugo and I were still taking very little money out of the business. We were quite impoverished at the time. And there wasn't a lot of money in the business either. And we'd opened a store in Great Portland Street. One of our very loyal and great customers, a chap called Nick Lander, who actually is the Financial Times food critic, used to come in every morning and buy his coffee. And one day he came up to Hugo and I and said, listen, I've been asked to run the tender process for the V&A, and I just wonder whether you guys would be interested. And we barely knew what the V&A was, to be honest with you. I mean, I knew it was a lovely museum, but I knew nothing about their catering. And we said, yes, of course. And it was, again, a bit like Lehman Brothers experience. Well, you have to put a tender document together. I mean, I have to say we did something more than a napkin for them, but not a lot. And we came in and we had to pitch to the board of the V&A, the trustee board, one of which was actually Lord Sainsbury, who grilled us massively. But, you know, we always were quite true to ourselves and what we could actually do as opposed to what they wanted to hear and what we felt that the V&A customers would really, really want. And the interesting thing was that it came to us and, you know, it was a big tender process and it's going from 10 to 5 to 4. And then it came to 2 and they had a vote and there were equal numbers for us and there was equal numbers for our competitor. And Lord Sainsbury had the casting vote and he apparently said to the trustees, I need to ask one question. He said, what do you sell most of at the V&A? And somebody said, well, I think it's sandwiches. And he said, well, I suggest we give it to the sandwich boys then. And that decision by Lord Sainsbury changed Benugo overnight. It changed us, what we did, how, you know, we suddenly became almost chefs again, you know, as opposed to sandwich makers, we became chefs again because it wasn't just opening a cafe, it was running all their boardroom lunches, their, you know, openings of galleries and all sorts of other things that we do at the V&A beyond what you might see when you walk in there, which is absolutely fabulous. And the V&A have been incredible partners and we're still there. We've just signed up another 5-year contract with them and they've been huge supporters of Benugo over the years.
And you are in some other amazing places. I mean, if you cross the road, you're in the National History Museum, the Science Museum, the British Film Institute, Bletchley Park, the Royal Parks, lots of incredible places. Are there any little gems, any little stories from those openings, Ben, that really stand out? Anything funny or dramatic or very memorable?
You know, when you mobilise a contract like the British Museum, and, you know, effectively the way this works is you take over from someone else. Museums can't afford to close their catering. So they will close at 5 o'clock and you're expected to open at 10 o'clock the next day with a completely different offer, with enthusiastic, talented people. And effectively you queue up outside. I mean, I remember when we did Edinburgh, we won the contract to run 7 castles right across Scotland. And we weren't even in Scotland, you know, we'd actually not even gone outside London. And by some bizarre chance, they awarded us this contract. And I remember sitting there with Hugo going, how the hell are we going to mobilise 7 castles? And to this day, I just can't remember, you know, how it happened. I had lorries. We had probably 12 lorries parked up outside Edinburgh Castle at 5 o'clock. And we worked, you know, we worked night in, day out to get these things mobilised and open. And, you know, we managed it, but we were young then, Helen. We were young and energetic. We have an incredible team. You know, as I mentioned, we've got almost 3,000 people who work for Benugo, but it never feels like that. It feels like a family business. And we talk a lot about the culture of Benugo, and the culture of Benugo is so important. We have many of our team have been with Benugo almost since the beginning, 15, 20 years of working in Benugo. And some of the guys who had started as team members are now commercial director or operations director or in charge of projects or in charge of food. So they've come up through the ranks and I'm very, very, very fortunate to have a great team of people who just would step in front of a bus for it. It's amazing.
And how have you managed to stay true to your vision and true to provenance, scaling up to the size that you've managed to scale up to?
Well, again, it's not easy. A lot of the stuff that I was taught from when I rode at school and when I worked for people like Raymond Blanc is total discipline. It really is. It is never going off the course. And it will be so easy for us to, and cheaper for us to, not to use organic milk, for example, in coffee. You know, nobody really tastes the difference. You know, you can't really taste the difference. But it's a personal thing of mine that I want happy cows to produce milk that I just feel is better for people and better for us and better for business. It would be a massive cost saving for us not to do that. Our coffee is a really good example. We pay our coffee growers direct. We then have our coffee roasted for us. I visited some of the farms that coffee comes from. I've seen the way the extra money that we pay really help those communities. And we sponsor them on buying computers, healthcare, dental care, all those sort of things, free meals for the children who work in those communities. Does the coffee taste better for it? I think it does. Morally, it tastes better. I think our coffee is great. Others might not say the same, but I think it is. But I think it's total discipline. And there were lots of shortcuts you can make. We mentioned the coffee machines. It will be so much quicker and cheaper and easier for us to go to push button machines. But there's no skill in that. You get a much better cup of coffee when you have somebody with a stopwatch around there, the thing, who are timing the grinders, timing the flow rates, learning in our barista academy how to do latte art. The froth is absolutely perfect on every flat white that you will ever have. And, you know, you can get a shamrock on there or a heart or something else. And it's a skill. We employ many talented people. We employ people from all around the world. Some are lawyers, some are doctors, come from all sorts of professional backgrounds, and they come to us and they work for us for a year. They want to learn English or something, and they go back to their own countries. And I like to think they've learned a skill when they go. And that's what it's all about. So we do lots of classes, in English classes, we do cooking classes, we do all sorts of things for our people. And that's why I think they stay with us for long periods. And so many people have left and gone back to their own countries and then come back again. And we're more than happy to re-employ them.
Most businesses at some stage or other go through some difficult times. At any point have you gone through tough times, Ben?
Oh my God, yes, absolutely we have. I mean, there were times, particularly in the early stages, where we really couldn't afford to pay our suppliers. And I had to certainly beg and borrow money of friends and investors, remortgage my own house. And there was a lot on the line in the early stages in Benugo. It's interesting because Benugo has grown organically, meaning that as we've made profits, we've invested those back into the business. Again, you know, we've never paid ourselves huge salaries. It's always been about the future of the business and reinvesting it back into making things better. And catering businesses are tough. You know, the high street is a really, really tough place to be. It's like the wild frontiers out there. And since we opened, so many other people have opened, and you only have to walk down the high street to see what the competition's like. I suppose the wisdom, if you can call it that, of Benugo is our business runs into four or five different areas. So when one area is doing poorly, perhaps one of the other areas is doing well. So a good example of that is the work that we do with the Royal Parks. Those are predominantly incredibly busy places, particularly in the summer. Now, what happens in the summer is the museums, weirdly enough, particularly if it's hot outside, drop off quite a bit. So we can use our team in the parks that were in the museums to swap over. So when our competition is tough in perhaps the high street, we have other parts of our businesses that are doing very, very well that can support it.
When you have gone through tough times and you've, you know, had to beg and borrow, how do you cope personally, Ben, with the stress and the strain that running a big business carries?
Oh, God. I mentioned before I did a lot of rowing at school, and I still do that. And I think any type of sport, any type of exercise is incredibly good for your, not just for your physical well-being, but for your emotional well-being. And I've had some of my eureka moments, I think, when I've been out on a long run or when I've been out on the river rowing or something about our business. And actually, you know, it clears your head and allows you to reset the button. I think exercise has really been probably the most important thing, apart obviously from my family. I have three children now and a dog. But what gets me out of bed is the excitement, not of how much money we're going to take, but how many people we're going to hopefully improve their day by serving them something that they really enjoy and great. And nothing gives me more pleasure. If I'm in the Benugo Bar and Kitchen on the South Bank and I'm sitting there having dinner in that restaurant and overhearing the table next to us talking about the wonderful food they're eating and about the great atmosphere and about it being a crazy night, nothing fills me with more pleasure than that.
You're filled with pleasure, but you feel a bit sick and queasy sometimes, don't you, when you go into your own establishments?
I absolutely do. I'll tell you, I'm our worst critic. I am our worst critic. And I spend most of my time walking around all of the different things that we do. And I tell you, every single one I walk towards, there is a feeling of real nervousness. My heart rate starts going up. And it's not because our people do a poor job. It's just sometimes it's just not right, not how I want it. And, you know, that can be about the music being at the wrong level, the temperature of the shop being too cold or too hot, people finishing their lunch or their coffee cups and they're still being on the table, or not enough sandwiches being made. You know, and I think probably that's one of the reasons it's successful. You know, we've never been complacent and we've always wanted it to be better, and actually thinking about really what people want to eat as opposed sometimes to what we think they want to eat.
You've grown organically over the last 20 years. I just wonder what your hope for the next 20 years is and whether you actually have a plan as long as that, or whether it's just to continue organically with new ideas and change.
I'm really, really not ready to retire. I'm really going to keep going. And my enthusiasm for Benugo over some years has waned, I don't know, for one reason or another. But I've got to say, as I feel now, I have never been more impassioned and enthusiastic to make this business better and bigger. There's a world out there. At the moment, we're only in the UK. We've had loads of opportunities and offers to go elsewhere. We haven't done, because I just feel that we've got to do a lot more here before we can go somewhere else. But it is an ambition to go to other areas, particularly America, particularly Europe. Benugo has never, ever, ever lost a contract in its entire 21 years. So everybody that we have ever catered for, we're still catering for. And those are big names. I mean, the British Museum, we are the only company ever to have been awarded the contract twice. We control the whole of South Kensington, the Science Museum, the Natural History Museum, the V&A. No other catering business has ever done that. So, you know, I got to make sure that we continue to do that, or that we continue to be the best in our market, to be not just the best, to be exceptional. And I believe if we're exceptional, no one is ever going to access, you know, no one is ever going to want someone different. So it's hard to stay ahead. Our competitors are biting at our heels, but we are going to stay ahead through great people, people who believe in the same culture, the same vision as I do. And we want to stay ahead of our competition. We want to do more. So Benugo is over 100 million now. It could be a £200 million business. It could be a 300, but that's not so important to me. What's mainly important to me is we continue to just do a really, really good job where we currently are. And hopefully if we continue to do that, then we will lead on to other things.
On a final note, Ben, what would you say to somebody who's got a dream and just thinks it's too big to realise?
I would always say go for it. I mean, I know there's lots of complexities in that. Start with something small. Start with something you can manage. The biggest issue I find with people who are starting these small businesses is they're underfunded, and Benugo was underfunded as well. And it really, really is a terrible struggle if you're underfunded, because most businesses don't hit the road running. You know, they require nurturing and they require many, many, many months and perhaps years of loss making before they become successful. So a lot of businesses, a lot of people I know who start these businesses, particularly coffee businesses, they run out of money before they can ever realise their success. So I think you need to start reasonably small, although have big aspirations. Make sure that you are well funded and make sure you know quite a bit about it as well. Do your research and make sure you understand it. It requires a lot of discipline and a lot of knowledge. And then there's the X factor, which I think Benugo have been very lucky with.
We might credit the builder with the X factor, might we?
I can credit a lot of people along the way with the X factor part of Benugo. I'm incredibly fortunate, as I've always said, that a lot of people have helped us, supported us and come up with great ideas and given us opportunities far bigger than we could ever punch at under normal circumstances, and trusted us and allowed us to pay them late and given us more credit than they should have done. And we are hugely, hugely indebted to all those people who've helped and supported us over the years.
When I asked you to record a podcast with me, you joked that you thought you might not be interesting enough compared to some of my other guests. Well, I just want to tell you, Ben Warner, you are right up there. You have the X factor. And yes, and I really appreciate how honest and frank you've been. And it's been fantastic that you've shared your story with us today. Thank you very much indeed.
Not at all. Not at all. I'm really enjoyed doing it. And hopefully there is something in there that will be of some use to someone out there.
Well, that was Ben Warner, who founded Benugo Cafes and Restaurants with his brother Hugo more than 20 years ago. I hope you've enjoyed Ben's story as much as I have. Please feel free to share this Convex podcast with your friends and family on socials, and do join me for another one very soon. Bye for now.